If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 515, Universal Love and Struggle. Prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Thursday, November 9th, 2017. It has been a long time since I've said those words. It's been, in fact, since May, since I put out an episode of this, the regular Sea Realm podcast. Now, I know many of you hear me all the time because I still do the Sea Realm Vault podcast, and I still do the Sea Realm radio show each week, which I put up on this RSS feed. But curiously, about a quarter of you don't listen to the radio show. I put it up on the same feed. It should come to you in the same way, but for whatever reason, these regular Sea Realm podcasts get about, I don't know, 500 to 700, somewhere in that range, more downloads than the weekly radio show. And I know that at least one person said that the local public service announcements that I do on the radio show were a turnoff, and they didn't listen for that reason. Well, for many months now, I have been editing those out of the podcast version. So if that was what was holding you back, please come and listen to the radio show. It's basically the Sea Realm podcast, just with less editing. Alrighty, so it is. We've just passed a historical mile marker, the official end of the Russian Revolution, which in time gave birth to the Soviet Union, was November 7th, 1917, 100 years ago, the day before yesterday. Now that's a pretty big deal. I am absolutely no expert on the history of the Soviet Union, or particularly on communism. I know a lot of people in my podcasting circles are either Marxists or, as Doug Lane describes himself, as a wannabe Marxist. Tom, over at the From Alpha to Omega podcast, was not any sort of Marxist when he started doing his podcast. He was basically just interested in economics. And as he gained familiarity with Marxist critiques of capitalism, he took an interest and he read at least the first volume of Capital. And, well, he was just off to the races. At this point, I think maybe he counts himself as a Marxist. I'm not sure, but he's certainly friendly to the Marxist perspective. I myself am not a Marxist. I am interested. I am open to hearing their ideas. And as you listen to the coming conversation with Leo Zhao, and I'm not going to pronounce his other name. He has a name in three parts, as do I. But the middle one just doesn't agree with the conditioned reflexes of my mouth, lips, and tongue. But as you listen to my conversation with Leo, you will notice that he will say things in praise of the Soviet Union and of Soviet communism, and also of Chinese communism under Mao, that will sound just plain wrong to you, particularly if you are my age or older. Now, Leo, I think, is 6 years younger than me. That makes him a late Gen Xer. So he's not a millennial. He is somebody who, you know, maybe we need some new vocabulary for this, but like me, he is in middle age. He was born in communist China. He and his family escaped that country and that totalitarian regime, came to the United States, struggled with poverty and not speaking the language. And Leo grew up basically as a champion of capitalism, hating communism. And it wasn't until much later, after much study and much discussion with other people, that he came to realize that he does agree with the expressed values of communism, which, as you'll hear in the conversation, caused a rift, to say the least, with his family. But you will hear Leo say things that you will probably think that I should stop him and object to, and I don't. I just let him go. Toward the end, you know, I let out a couple of little mini rants of my own just to relieve pressure. My own opinions had been bottled up and the pressure was building, and I do vent that pressure on a couple of occasions, but in a minor way. I mostly let Leo talk. So if you are just incensed at praise for communism and particularly for the Soviet Union, well, I get it, but you don't need to write to me or post anything online about it. We can just take that as read. What I would like feedback on is if either Leo or I get any historical details wrong, because I've left in these comments, we both admit repeatedly that our knowledge of history in particularly vital subject areas for this conversation is lacking. You know, I have a lot to do. I do a lot of different things, and I do a lot of reading, and it's almost all for, you know, in preparation for a video or for a radio show or for a podcast. And there's just never a moment in my life where I, you know, think I'm just going to wander on down to the public library and pick up a history book and start reading. I know that there are some of you listening who do exactly that, and I value your input. So if we get anything glaringly wrong in terms of historical fact in the coming conversation, please let me know. You probably know how to contact me, but if not, I'll give contact info at the end of the podcast. But for now, here's my conversation with Leo Zhao.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
So you are in, what is it, Berlin?
I am.
I would say East Berlin or West Berlin, but they're one city now, right?
Yeah, I'm in the former East.
Uh-huh. So does it look different from the West?
It does. The architecture looks a bit different. And, you know, the culture is a little bit different. I mean, it's a total taboo in this city, in this country, to talk about the former East. It's like
people really,
people really want to brush that entire history under the rug. And in fact, there's a lot of very important historical information that people just are not aware of that shaped modern Germany. And especially the gap between the citizens of the former East and of the West, and the poverty that exists in the eastern part.
So 30 years on, East Berlin is still a much poorer place than West Berlin?
Yes, absolutely. And the former citizens of the East were systematically, legally deprived of their economic of their property, actually. I guess, okay, let's jump into a sort of a like tangent here. After the wall came down, the East, the DDR, the East German government, was still intact. It didn't fall. The wall just came down, and a new vanguard kind of revolutionary party was formed in the former East that wanted to address some of the problems of the USSR. Well, that wanted to address all the problems, the totalitarianism and blah blah blah, and sort of start afresh, like an authentic communist state, and you know, and move towards a brighter future. And a lot of East Germans were in support of this, because life under the former East was not only terrible. You know, I mean, of course, there were terrible things, and we can get into that later, why that is and how the USSR became such a terrible place, and as well as China, my home country. But yeah, we can talk about that a little bit later. But a lot of the East Germans were for this new government. But the CDU, the Social Democrat Party of the West, sort of made a huge campaign with a lot of funding and sort of making empty promises to the East Germans that they will be better off, blah, blah, blah. And the East Germans, you know, not being versed in sort of like the social democratic, a little bit naive, and they sort of believed it and they voted CDU. And all those promises were broken. And what happened was actually all of their belongings, or their savings, actually, the money that they had was quartered. So they were completely just deprived, just basically completely like got a very, very bad deal.
So mechanism was their savings cut down like that?
Yeah, some legal procedure, some kind of policy, some kind of, I don't know the details, but basically it was not reunification. The West devoured the former East, and that's what shaped. And so today, fast forward to today, a lot of the former East are very poor, and a lot of extreme right has arisen in the poverty and in their situation.
Is rent more affordable in the East?
Well, that's about the same.
Is it?
Actually, the neighborhood I live in is kind of expensive.
Huh. So poor people from the West didn't move to the East.
They did.
Oh, they
absolutely
did.
They bought all the property as soon as the wall came down, or like as soon as all of this happened. The West bought like most of the property, the land from the former East, at very, very low prices.
Because as I understand it, when the Soviet Union fell, the people who were living in government-provided housing basically just became the owners of the places where they were living. So they got, you know, a sudden windfall of equity, you know, in the place where they lived. But it sounds like that's not what happened in East Germany.
No, it's not. I'm not sure exactly about those details in the Soviet Union about when the wall fell. But, you know, like I was saying, this is a very opportune time for us to have a conversation, because yesterday was a very important day. Well, yesterday, 100 years ago, and this week commemorates the 100th anniversary of the Soviet Revolution.
And what does that mean to you?
Well, so much. I mean, how do I even begin answering that?
yeah, it's okay. A good question.
From a radical perspective, radical meaning getting to the fundamentals of my relationship to all of this history and all of this politics. I was born in China, as you know. I grew up there, but I'm a communist. But I'm still a communist. My parents were sent to the re-education camps. They labored under like horrible conditions for many years. My father about 5 or 6 years, my mother about 4 years, I think. And it's basically psychological torture and just horrible. They would build dams by hand, and then as soon as the dam was built, they would blow it up and they would have to start all over again. It's basically psychological torture. But anyway, as a result of this history and experience, basically, I feel the consequences of that every day. My family is tragically, completely broken, irreparably. I'm estranged from my family, and it's very sad personally.
Where are they?
Actually, they are in the U.S. We emigrated to the U.S. together in 1986 when I was 12. And so I grew up hating communism. I grew up sort of embracing capitalism, the American lifestyle. And it's only in the last 5 to 10 years that I've reassessed all of that historical process and sort of make sense of it for myself in order to understand, you know, like why I feel the things that I do on a daily basis, you know, to understand what happened in 1917, starting there, or perhaps starting in 1879 in France, or, you know, just that entire historical process. So it really helped me make sense of my own life.
Are you familiar with the narrative that the Kaiser's government in World War I sent Lenin to Russia in order to destabilize Russia and take them out of the war, and that it basically worked?
Yeah, I am aware of that.
Do you accept that, or do you think that sounds sort of like propaganda?
Well, it could be the case. I don't think it makes a very big difference in our understanding of what transpired afterwards. I don't think that makes a very big difference if it was a move by the Kaiser, you know, and by the fascists. But anyway, yeah, I don't think it makes a very big difference.
Well, I think it makes a difference in that Lenin was really fanatical, and there were competing versions of communism, you know, revolutionary communism, and the one that won out was not necessarily the one that I think a lot of people, you know, particularly Trotskyites, yeah, would like to have seen win out. That there could have been a less tyrannical version of the Soviet Union, and that might have created a very different global situation over the course of the 20th century.
Yeah, I accept that.
Would you talk about the relationship between Soviet and Chinese communism?
Well, China had a very different circumstance, had very different material realities. I mean, there were some similarities. Both were agriculture-based economies, and both needed to industrialize. But China had different circumstances, and so Maoism took very much from Marxism, obviously. But there were Chinese, basically it was the peasants. It was a peasant revolution in China, as opposed to workers' revolution.
This will seem off topic for, you know, a moment, but I think we'll work around to integrate it. What is the name of your Facebook group?
Currently it's a pluralist accord of a pluralist.
So even you don't know it.
Yeah, I mean, it's changed a couple of times.
But you are the final arbiter on what the name is, so seemingly the one that you've picked doesn't roll off the tongue so well.
Yeah, it's kind of by design as well, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody wants these names that you can remember, and, you know, why not have a kind of a cumbersome name? Doesn't really matter.
You started the group when you, a former moderator of the anarcho-communism group, got kicked out of that group.
Yes.
Would you like to talk about that for a bit? I mean, I'm working around to getting a sort of feel for the different players, you know, ideological players that are in the circles that you move in and that I sort of observe and pass through from time to time.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, the left has sort of succumbed to a liberal turn in. You know, in general, in the world, since...
What does that mean?
It means a focus on the individual.
Mm-hmm.
It means internalizing the systematic injustices of the world and sort of focusing on individuals than critiquing. And postmodernism, you know, this focus on language and this focus on analyzing power and systems and history, which I do think is at its core emancipatory impulse. But a lot of academics, I mean, the left sort of went to the academies starting the 1960s and sort of got caught up in deconstructing master narratives and deconstructing science and knowledge and epistemology, and sort of neglected grassroots organization and connecting with the working class ever since the 1960s. And so with the 1980s turn, the financialization of the market and Reagan and Thatcher and all of this, the left sort of moved towards this sort of liberal procedural, like this liberal mindset. And politics became increasingly like moving away from politics itself and into this sort of talking about endlessly analyzing the situation that we're in instead of organizing. And so what happens today in these so-called leftist groups, I mean, I don't say they're fake, but it's really distorted and like, so identity politics became a huge thing since the 90s. And today these groups, especially online, I think, are really focused on not class, but race and sexuality and all of these things. And so a certain kind of hopelessness, I think, is at the center of this turn. People realize that there was actually no apparent possibilities of actually making significant social change. People sort of lost their belief in collectivity, especially since the fall of the Soviet Union. That kind of signaled a major symbolic kind of an actual collapse of the left. And I think there's this like deep, deep hopelessness that has taken root. And so in the face of an inability to actually cause a significant actual political change in the way that we relate to each other, in the commodified reality of late capitalism, I think people then turned on each other and started policing each other's behavior. And like in the left, you know, all of the conversations are about racism and trans issues, and which are all important. But like we were talking about last time, they're ancillary injustices.
They're important, but the left currently seems to be, at least, you know, particularly the academic left, seems to be focused on addressing them by criticizing individual people for their failure to use correct language, which exactly. is not, it's not a systemic approach at all. I mean, it does not really address the structures in society or the traditions in society or the, you know, the shared unspoken assumptions that give rise to individual behavior. You know, just focusing on the individual behavior, it, to me, it just seems like a game of one-upsmanship and, you know, holier-than-thou-manship.
Absolutely. That's exactly what is happening. And so in that group, I was an admin for a few months, and everything was going great until, you know, certain things happened, and I was labeled any name that you can imagine. I was called
racist, sexist, transphobe, homophobe, all of that.
Exactly, all of that. Mm-hmm. And for ridiculous reasons, just completely ridiculous.
So I did log into Facebook and I am looking at your group. The title of the group is A Pluralist Accord of Differences United by Universal Love and Struggle, which I think is a great title. It's just I don't have it committed to memory. And there are 2,099 members in the group, which I think is more members than the Friends of the Sea Realm. And Facebook is showing me that lots of people in this group are people that I know in real life, not just online.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yep. Yep. So there are lots of abbreviations, you know, that get used. And I didn't know what some of them were. Like somebody was throwing around MLM the other day. And to me, that's multi-level marketing, which is, you know, from hell. What is MLM in the shorthand of your group? Just ML, I know, is Marxist-Leninism.
Yeah, and then add Maoism to that, and then you have MLM.
So what is Maoism, and what is Marxist-Leninist Maoism?
Maoism arose from specific conditions of the Chinese Revolution, which I still need to read much more about. But
as do I.
Anti-imperial, I think... Maoism had a much more anti-colonial stance because China's economy was, you know, manipulated and controlled by the British for a long time, and then Japan invasion and all of this. And so Maoism was born in such a context. And a lot of the tactics that Mao used in his anti-imperial and colonial struggles became a part of Maoism.
If somebody today, say living in the United States, identifies themselves as a Maoist, what can we infer from their beliefs and their desires based on that?
Well, Maoism had a lot of advantages in the tactics that it uses. It really focuses on grassroots organization. Basically, community gardens. I mean, the Black Panthers were Maoists. Well, if not explicitly, they drew heavily from Maoism in their organization, like the free breakfast program and the community organizing. All of that was very much inspired by Maoism. Sort of, you know, local communities building away from the capitalist order. Sort of, you know, new society giving birth to itself from inside the corrupt shells of the old. And that's a large part of Maoism. And so the Black Panthers and very many prominent thinkers on the left today call themselves Maoists. And yeah, I mean, the term is very heavily loaded, especially since the Cultural Revolution and all of those things that happened, as I mentioned earlier, which has a personal, very negative and disastrous effect on people, on myself and my family. So the term is complicated. But in order to understand, you know, and how it's possible for me to call myself a communist today. You have to really understand the historical context and the things that happened. And to most people in the U.S., the story is very one-sided. It's very biased. People's heads are filled with a one-sided view, which discounts a lot of actual history and things that happened.
Like what?
Like, for instance, the famine that happened in the USSR in the Ukraine, what is called the Holodomor. I've talked to Ukrainians who endlessly talk about the evils of the USSR and how, you know, their country was destroyed and blah, blah, blah. And they talk about the famine, which happened in the 1930s in the Ukraine, and blame it on the Soviet state, just basically repeating the dominant capitalist perspectives on those things. Well, let's look at actual historical things that happened. To begin with, famines in Ukraine had been historically recurring every 100 years or so, or however long. It was, you know, a thing that happened before the Soviets took power. So it's a natural occurrence, right? Another factor which is completely ignored and not mentioned is the gold sanctions put on the USSR by the US and other capitalist powers of the time. The economic violence exacted on the Soviet Union cannot be underestimated. It was a very, very, very powerful force that made life and development very difficult in the newly formed USSR. So the gold sanction made it impossible for the USSR to trade with gold. And they needed to industrialize at the time for self-preservation, basically. And so without the ability to trade in gold for machines and for equipment with Germany, with France, with England, and with the U.S., they had to resort to agricultural goods. And so what happened with the Ukrainian famine is that Stalin basically had to make a choice. You know, he bet on a good harvest that year and used the grains to trade for, you know, towards industrialization. But his bet, you know, he lost, and the harvest was very bad that year. And so so what happened was the famine, which had, you know, occurred many, many times before the Soviet Union. So the gold sanctions, that's a big part of it. And, you know, just the bias towards all of this, right? Towards this thing that happened. How many millions died in the 1930s in the U.S. because of famine? The Great Depression, right? I don't have the numbers readily, but many, many, like a huge part of the population actually starved to death. But anyway, this is never, ever blamed on capitalism, right? The famine that happened in the U.S. And why is the famine that happened in the Ukraine blamed on communism? This is just like a insupportable, indefensible bias. I mean, in similar ways, you know, communism is just completely demonized. And this propaganda is so deep that the vast majority of people today, especially probably in the US, as well as Western Europe and all over the world, as well as China, basically the entire world, just have this very skewed, biased view of communism. Basically, I mean, in a nutshell, a group of people attempted to create a more just, fair, peaceful society that benefits everyone, of a society of cooperation, moving away from capitalism. And this was very much a big threat to the property holders, to the rich of the capitalist countries, to the elites, to the people that hold power. And not 2 weeks passed since this successful revolution, the white army from the U.S. invaded the USSR and tried to destroy the revolution. And ever since then, the economic violence that I had mentioned before, the legal, political violence exacted on the Soviet Union, destabilization efforts, as well as military, physical violence. I mean, the Vietnam War is a part of that. I mean, the first strategy, the first proposed strategy on how to deal with the problem of communism was to drop atomic bombs on Russia and just wipe out the entire country. And many, many in the U.S. government were in support of this, but it did not pass. What passed instead of the total destruction of the USSR, because communism was a threat to the wealth of the elites, was a containment strategy, which in practice meant things like the Vietnam War, of eliminating communism and socialist states that were attempting communism at, you know, by any means necessary. And so, you know, it was this great meme, you know, communism works on paper, but in reality, it just gets usually destroyed by the CIA. And, you know, communism doesn't work in practice, but the U.S. had to kill however many, 2 million Vietnamese people in order to stop it from spreading. And so this entire history is one of aggression coming from one side. I mean, people endlessly tout this violence from both sides and that both sides were wrong. I mean, this is largely a crock of shit. I mean, I don't know if I can say that on the radio, but this is
actually for the C-Realm podcast. So yeah, you can say anything you like.
Oh, okay, great. So yeah, so it's complete bullshit. The aggression was coming from the capitalist forces because they wanted to keep their property rights. There's sacred property rights and to prevent this more fair and just society from a political organization from spreading across the world.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
So go ahead and personalize that narrative. How does all that play into your basically being kicked out of a more mainstream and very large group that you absolutely loved participating in, the anarcho-communist group, and starting your own new group?
Well, I mean, many, many things have happened since the stuff that I'm talking about. I mean, the turn to sort of individualism, you know, in the left contributes to this culture of identity politics and, you know, pointing fingers and blaming individuals. And so yeah, I mean, it gets to, you know, absurd levels of just completely absurd levels of demonization of individuals and blaming and guilt tripping. And it's funny that in my experience and many, many other people's experience, it's usually white males on the left that have adopted this hardcore identity politics stance and using it as a kind of police, you know, nightstick to beat people with.
Which is weird because the ideology itself seems to demonize white males in particular, particularly straight white males or cisgendered straight white males.
Yeah, yeah, it is ironic, but it is them in the left who you know, endlessly they basically self-hate and and to show that they are pure, they're ideologically pure. And yeah, they've taken on these positions. It's just, I mean, it's kind of like the worst part of, you know, Maoism, of what happened during the Cultural Revolution, you know, of shaming people for listening to a record by, you know, a Western composer, or reading Einstein. That was, you know, a horrible thing in the Cultural Revolution, because it's corrupt capitalist, you know, culture or whatever. So those are the absurd extremes that current identity politics is approaching, if not already surpassed. So they would demonize people for not only using the wrong language, but, you know, weird things like, okay, one incident that happened, there was this girl, she, for whatever stupid reason, I would get criticized for using the word stupid, but
yep.
I don't buy into that or whatever. For whatever dumb reason, she was talking about her boyfriend who is black, and she said something about, I don't know why she even was saying this in public in a political group. She was saying that her boyfriend is so hot and blah blah blah, and it was the first black guy that she ever dated. And these people started accusing her of being a racist. And I jumped in as an admin, and I said, wait a second. I don't think that's what she means at all. She's not, you know, clued in on the fetishization of the black race and the history of seeing them as sex objects, blah, blah, blah. I don't think that's what, let's go easy on her. And so because I said this, they accused me of talking over people of color, even though I'm not white. I'm a person of color, but I have lighter skin, so I have more privilege than black people. So I was talking over black people. So then I became a racist in their eyes. So they started accusing me of racism, of anti-blackness. And it just because of this little incident, just because of this girl, you know, saying something dumb, you know, and I sort of like, you know, defending her, you know, they began to slander me as a racist.
Well, you used her transgression as, you know, a potential teachable moment, and they wanted to use her transgression as an excuse to dogpile. So, you know,
yeah, exactly.
There was competing agendas there.
Yeah, and I don't know why it was not protecting a female from the aggression of males. You know, I don't know why it was not, you know, put in that frame, but rather. Anyway, whatever. It's just ridiculous. This is completely ridiculousness, and completely. I mean, this signals. I mean, this is a symbol. This is a good example of how the left has lost its way. How the left turned inward and just like in reenacting endless rites of exclusion and inclusion. These endless rites of like ideological purity in terms of identity politics. And, you know, I mean, intersectionality, of course, it's real. I mean, it very well, it's a very good analytical tool to understand how these oppressions are intersectional, how they intersect, right? But
I hate to ask this question, but would you define intersectionality for people who are a little fuzzy on the concept?
Yeah, the term was coined by this activist, this African-American woman activist in the 80s, I think. Her name is Crenshaw, something Crenshaw. But she described at the moment, you know, these black women would file, you know, complaints or lawsuits about racial discrimination or other kinds of discrimination. And these cases were systematically thrown out of court because it was proven that, well, on this company, there were also other black people, you know, so it's not racism. Or on the, you know, or in this circumstance, there were also other females, you know, so it's not, you know, against you as a woman. And so intersectionality describes how these different oppressions on different lines of identity, identitarian lines intersect, and how people are victimized and oppressed by all of them, by their intersection. So that's intersectionality. Now, the thing is, it's a very important and accurate way to understand the various oppressions that minorities face today. But I don't think it does much more than that, than basically a way to understand how these things happen. I don't think it's a intersectionality can be a vector for actual social change. It's not a way to organize. It's not a way to bringing people together, if you know what I mean.
Well, I've heard intersectionality described in a variety of ways. The distilled version that Google gives me when I ask for a definition is the interconnected nature of social categorizations, such as race, class, gender, as they apply to a given individual or group, regarded as creating overlapping and interdependent systems of discrimination or disadvantage. And then the example they give is, through an awareness of intersectionality, we can better acknowledge and ground the differences among us. That is pretty clear to me, but I don't know that everybody that I hear invoking the concept of intersectionality has that definition in mind. And, you know, I'm sure you've heard a reference to the oppression Olympics, which is people who are critical of, current leftist dialogue and theory often say about intersectionality, that it creates this checklist of different, oppressed groups. And the more boxes that you can check off, you know, the more oppressed you are, which means the higher status you have, or the more you are insulated from criticism in any sort of conversation. You know, if you are black, transgendered, female, homosexual, you know, the more these boxes you can check off, the more of a star you become, and the more bulletproof you become, and the more you can criticize other people based on things that are really beyond their control.
Yeah, that's sadly pretty accurate.
Okay, well, I almost got to sermonizing there, so I'll stop and pass the baton back to you. Hey, let me ask you, though. From a couple years ago, say, and I don't have an exact chronology, but I remember there was a time when you would post to the Friends of the CROM group, and the things that you were posting, the language seemed identical to so many other people, you know, that I see online. It seemed as though you were just posting these off-the-shelf opinions, which were very much, you know, informed by the current leftism, which you now criticize. And today, I mean, not, you know, this very day, but these days, when I read the things that you're posting to your own group, you have a very distinctive voice. It's definitely something that, you know, you have cultivated, and it's something that I look forward to reading. And I wonder, you know, where you've been in the last couple of years, which has caused this shift.
Well, I mean, I was a social justice warrior before the term social justice warrior was born, right? I'm a person of color. I face a lot of racism in my life, and classism as well. I mean, being a four-eyed Chinese kid that didn't speak English, brought to the United States at age 11, who wore the same clothes to school every day because we couldn't afford any clothes. It was all secondhand clothes. I wore literally the same shirt every day. For the first few years I was in the United States, I faced a lot of discrimination and a lot of, like really horrible things that has shaped my personality and shaped who I am. And so, of course, I'm an anti-racist, and of course, I'm a feminist. I took feminist classes in university, and I thoroughly believe that feminism means the liberation of not only women but also of men, and that the real goals of feminism, which is to dismantle patriarchy, is beneficial to men as well. And so, all of this, I thoroughly believe, and I'm even, you know, at the core, sympathetic to identity politics. Of course, we need to fight against racism. Of course, we need to fight against oppression that it gets distributed along any number of these lines, you know, and that intersect as well. Of course, we need to do that, but you know, this cannot be the main vector for organization. I mean, this just creates sectarian conflict, and it alienates people, and it, you know, blaming people for who they are, for the privilege that they were born into, and blaming people for, you know, inadvertently reproducing these oppressions, you know, making them feel bad about themselves. That's not a good way to proceed, whether, you know, you're trying to organize, you know, for social change, or just on a personal basis, on like on any level. It's just not a good way of doing things. Like if you make people feel bad, then, you know, these bad feelings, they turn and they become something even more toxic, which
it also tends to spark
with the rise of the alt-right. But
you think so?
I think it does, at least in part. I mean, it's difficult to say, obviously, how much identity politics has given rise to the alt-right, but at least in part, definitely people are alienated from this way of doing things. People, you know, are, I mean, a lot of these have some reactionary, you know, almost alt-right people in my network. And they absolutely feel this way. They feel like they need to apologize for being white. And so they react by, you know, going further into racism.
They react by saying, fuck that, I'm proud to be white. And, exactly. You know, white pride is absolutely forbidden. White pride is synonymous with, you know, Nazism.
Well, it is. But this is at least partially what
it seems the height of unfairness to say that, you know, people of color can be proud of their skin tone and their culture, but that white people cannot, that they must feel, if not ashamed, at least then utterly neutral about, you know, their heritage.
Well, I mean, the people who have all the power, right? There's no need for them to feel proud. Because they have,
yeah, but we're not talking about the people with the power. The people with the power are happy to embrace, or, you know, at least to appear to embrace leftist values today. The people who are demonized are generally poor people, or people, you know, whose family histories are not one of privilege.
Right, right, right. Yes. But, you know, a poor white person cannot rent a house because he's poor. A poor white person cannot rent a house not because he's white. You see?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there is a thing called white privilege, and that is a real thing, and it does exist.
Right. But then there are white people who are very privileged, and, you know, economically privileged and privileged with political power, who are quite willing to spur on this debate between, you know, the academic left and the postmodern left and the alt-right, because, you know, they have nothing to lose in this fight. As long as the leftists and the alt-right are fighting one another, nobody is challenging neoliberal capitalism. Nobody is challenging the current gross misdistribution of power and wealth. And it's just good. I mean, it's a great thing to have people at each other's throats, as long as their attention is turned away from the actual distribution of power and wealth.
Absolutely. They have nothing to lose, but everything to gain from these conflicts between minorities and between the poor. I mean, the concept of race itself was invented in such a situation, like with these. The concept of whiteness was born out of trying to give the poor whites of the U.S. in the 18th century, 17th century, an identity of making them feel like, okay, you're poor, you're being exploited by the rich, but at least you can feel proud that you're white and you're different from these other people, from these black people. I mean, there was solidarity between the poor blacks and the poor whites and the poor Asians and the poor American Indians, indigenous people of North America. There was solidarity between them, and they worked together, political organization and various things. And this was destroyed by the invention of whiteness and of race, basically. And we see this dynamic repeated throughout history. I mean, I just went to a lecture by an Indian historian who talked about the partition that happened in India. When was it? In the 70s? I'm a little bit shady on my history. But anyway, this benefited the English greatly. I mean, for to exploit these the conflict between Hindus and Islamic populations of India, and to exacerbate and to create. I mean, Hindus and Muslims lived peacefully for, you know, a long, long time, and then all of a sudden it became this huge conflict, which turned one country into two, and it's a very tragic thing that happened. So basically, I mean, this is a gross simplification, but identity politics divided India.
Well, Leo, we are getting to the point where we need to start wrapping this up, and I'd like to bring it full circle. You mentioned early on the historical significance of this week, it being 100 years on past the birth of the Soviet Union. Would you go back to that topic and tie in some of the things that we've talked about in the last hour to it?
Well, we're at a historical juncture where communism is beginning to be talked about again in a way that has not been possible for many, 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 many years. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, it was in the US, it's basically, you just don't talk about socialism. I mean, that just means evil, basically. And today, it's very hopeful and promising to hear, you know, these ideas coming back and people reevaluating that history and trying to get a real understanding of what transpired in the last century. Last night, I went to this little celebration of the anniversary here in Berlin, and I heard some parts of the new book from MIT Press, Communism for Kids, read aloud. And later, I had a beer with the author, actually. It was a very nice people, and so yeah, I think today, I mean, just like Rosa Luxemburg said, it's socialism, or basically not even barbarism, but total destruction. I think that's what we face today.
I'm looking at the page for the book now, Communism for Kids.
The Amazon reviews are hilarious.
I'm looking at the MIT Press page. I'll check out Amazon after we're off the line here.
Yeah, people just, you know, they're so deeply ingrained in this anti-communist propaganda. It's hilarious. I mean, people forget, you know, that they think that these ideas are just the truth, and they don't question them, and you know, people forget how they are shaped by society, by ideology, you know? I mean, just one small example, in the 1920s, pink was for boys and blue was for girls before the 1920s. And until some advertising campaign started, you know, creating this idea that pink is for girls and blue is for boys. And so now today we regard this as natural. We think it's just natural. Of course, pink is for girls. But we don't, you know, we forget that that's shaped by his particular circumstances and is not anything but natural. It's completely cultural, and their biases. You know, the same thing with communism. I mean, everybody hates communism, and they endlessly talk about the evils and the bad things that resulted, but they never mention the good things. You know, universal healthcare. I mean, the healthcare in Cuba is amazing. The education system in Cuba is amazing. Everyone has the right to a proper education, to healthcare, and all of these things. And even the Soviet Union, even there was a lot of advances, a lot of good things that happened besides the totalitarianism that resulted from largely, not completely, but largely from aggression from the capitalist countries.
Talking about how the color symbolism changes during the Cold War. Red stood for communism. You know, you ain't done nothing if you ain't been called a red. And now, you know, the red tribe in the United States is the more politically and socially conservative tribe. You'd think that it would be the reverse, that, you know, people in the middle of the country and in the South would be blue, and that people on the coasts, you know, the commie liberals on the coasts would be red. But it's the reverse.
Yeah, that's ironic. That's a funny thing. I hadn't thought about that. But yeah, it's a kind of basically a mess, which hopefully we're navigating through and reaching a new understanding, a new level of understanding.
Do you think that we are reaching a new level of understanding, or is this proliferation of views and this really delving into esoteric languages for talking about politics that people who don't share your opinions can't even follow, much less disagree with, so they just write you off as being incomprehensible? Do you think that we are really moving toward a new and beneficial consensus, or are we really just spiraling off into all little, our separate rabbit holes?
Well, both are happening, right? spiraling into our separate rabbit holes, being alienated subjects of the state of affairs. Of course, that's a very tragic thing. But at the same time, you know, I see a lot of people waking up, and I see a lot of people re-examining that history and re-examining what it means, what socialism means, what communism means, what anarchism means, and what, you know, the possibilities we have of creating a better world, or even just a sustainable world where we don't destroy our environments and where we don't, you know, exploit and dominate each other through these hierarchies based on private property, based on wealth. I mean, a lot of people are waking up. I mean, Occupy Wall Street, all of these things are positive things that, I mean, inequality was not a part of the political conversation before Occupy Wall Street. And now inequality is a major topic that everyone is addressing, that even major politicians are talking about. So that's like a real advance in consciousness. And, you know, in back to the ANCOM group, there were these, you know, age location posts, and I saw a lot of 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds commenting, like, I began to see the injustice of class society at the age of 9, and I started reading Marx by the age of 11. It was just astounding to me. It's amazing. And in the former Soviet Union, in Russia today, there is a new generation of communists that are coming up, as well as in China. I mean, China is it's complex. I mean, the state, I just saw this amazing address by the president, Xi Jinping, in which he used the word Marxism like 100 times during his speech. And this just gives me so many mixed feelings. It's amazing. I mean, on one hand, China is doing really great things in their large-scale environmental initiatives. And on the other hand, there is the inequality that persists. And but anyway, I think after Mao, after the Mao era, the long-term, large-scale planning of undertaken by the Chinese, quote, communist, unquote, government, or semi-authentic, is not even understandable by people in the West. It's just a kind of thinking that is very, very long-term. I mean, basically, from what I understand, the first stage is economic development, infrastructure, and at any cost. And the cost has been very high. But this first phase is almost complete, but the costs have been environmental problems and also inequality, and various other things as well. And now that the first phase is almost complete, I think the state is actually beginning to address some of these problems in the second phase, which is, you know, addressing inequality and pollution and in the environment and things like that. And so, yeah, anyway, I went off in a bit of a tangent about China.
Well, that's good, because I have a few observations/opinions/impressions that I'd like to share with you about China and see what your response is. To me, China, even though it's ruled by something that calls itself the Communist Party, just seems to be totalitarian, or at least authoritarian, capitalism. And, you know, China is definitely integrated into the world economy. It trades with other nations, you know, capitalist nations. It knows how to conduct business, and it's doing, you know, it's fallen into the same temptations as other capitalist countries. You know, there's a lot of corruption in banking and high finance.
Yep.
And it seems as though what China is demonstrating to the world is that part of U.S. propaganda throughout the Cold War that, you know, democracy is synonymous with capitalism is just nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, clearly, capitalism can exist and thrive in an authoritarian political environment. And another thing that China suggests to me is that, you know, maybe democracy is not something that is universally beneficial, and that if you're just focused on maintaining your political power, you tend to stay focused on the next electoral cycle. And if you are a totalitarian state that doesn't allow any competition from outside of your own party, and you don't have to worry so much about the next electoral cycle, then you can plan for the long term. You can make these really, you invest in things that aren't going to pay off for a very long time, because you don't need all of the payoffs from your actions to bear fruit, before the next electoral cycle. So those are one is hopeful, one is maybe gives cause for optimism, but I don't know. It seems whether one is hopeful and optimistic or pessimistic about the current situation in the West really just seems to come down to, one's personality. Because if you are bent on seeing, the capitalism as just wickedness enthroned and enshrined and raised to the highest ethical status of the land, then there's plenty of evidence for that. And if you want to see capitalism as this generative structure which unlocks the genius, which allows people to coordinate the actions of many and create abundance, well, there's plenty of evidence for that as well. So,
I don't see very much evidence of the latter. I mean, capitalism is very good with innovation, very limited to the innovations that generate
You cut out there. You said capitalism is very good with what?
With innovation, technological innovation. But mm-hmm. in a very limited sense, in that it only invests in innovations which makes a profit. The one thing that capitalism does is create ever greater concentrations of wealth. Because it's much easier for people who have money to make money. People, who have property, who own land, can just live off of rent. And people who own factories can live off of the surplus profit from the workers. And so this is the core of capitalism. I mean, this is not even debatable, because anyone can see it with their eyes. Everyone knows that people who own property, have it easy, right? And property from the very beginning was established and maintained today with violence. That's the core of capitalism, and reinvesting the surplus value into your business to make it grow. And if you don't grow, you die. And so this imperative to grow is also a part of capitalism. These are like factual, material, factual things that we cannot, ever like. It's not really arguable even. And so that's the truth. And now about China, I mean, since the Mao era, Deng Xiaoping famously said, white cat, black cat, whatever color, if it catches the rats, it's a good cat, right? And so what this means is that China had to make decisions based on the realities, on the global realities of global capitalism. And it had to, develop itself in that context. And so it had, opened up its businesses market to the global capitalist way of doing things. And but who's to know? I mean, who can tell? I think only time will tell what is truly, happening in China and how it will develop in the future.
Well, you could say that about just about anywhere, really.
Perhaps, but I mean, a part of me wants to believe that there is an authentic revolutionary, egalitarianism that is intact, even from within the Communist Party. There is an element of that. I think I would like to believe that. I'm not sure if that is actually the case, but I mean, there are, very positive developments, like local organizations, the real democracy being implemented in China, in the local governments.
Let me run this narrative past you. I think this comes from the Black Pigeon Speaks YouTube channel. I kind of get confused sometimes where, who I'm quoting, but I think that's the author of what I'm about to tell you, that people, wealthy people in China right now are looking, they're desperate to move their wealth out of China and, establish it elsewhere, because they fear for the stability of their own country. And their desire to get their wealth out of China and invested elsewhere is driving up real estate prices in places like Vancouver to absurd levels, where people who live there just can't afford to buy real estate or, even apartments anymore. And the same is certainly happening in New York City. where you have New York and American-based construction companies partnering with Chinese developers to build apartment buildings which are specifically tailored to, you know, to Chinese living, you know, ways of living. So that, you know, it is assumed that most of the people living in the building will actually be Chinese, that there is a desire on the part of the Chinese elites to get out of China and not be dependent, or, you know, not to share the fate of their country.
Well, I'm not sure how accurate that is. I mean, I'm sure that is happening, but I'm not sure how important, you know, on the bigger scheme of things that is. That's probably just an ancillary effect of the growing economy and, you know, the new class of rich people from China doing what they want. But I mean, as far as the instability of China, not sure. I mean, there was a lot of big talk in the West about the financial crash and China's economy is in trouble and all of this. But, you know, all of this, I really think that reporting about China is really seriously heavily biased and in the dark about what's actually happening. I mean, speaking to my friends, people that I know in China, it's a different, you know, I mean, life there is very, very, it's like Berlin, you know, people like on a summer day, you smell the ganja, you smell weed in the air. People are smoking weed on the streets, you know, and old people are playing chess and children are playing. It's a very peaceful existence. And then there's hardly any crime, hardly any violent crime. And if you live in, yeah, I mean, from what I hear is very nice today and very, very free. I mean, the totalitarianism that we endlessly talk about in China, I'm sure it exists in their oppression of certain groups and with Tibet and the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. There's a lot of problems for sure, and there's this censorship and things like that. But how that actually translates to the experience of people living there, I'm not sure how to what extent it does. You know, these problems do exist, but it's not everything, and it's not as important as it doesn't play as big a role as many journalists in the West make it seem.
Well, we're definitely out of time. I'm going to have to be cutting a few things out of the middle of our conversation to make it all fit already. So let me bring us to a close here and say, Leo, would you pronounce your full name for me? The middle one still doesn't quite roll off my tongue.
It's Zhao He.
Okay.
It's basically impossible for foreigners to get right. That's why I chose the name Leo, to make it easy on everybody.
Well, Leo, thank you very much for all the writing that you've been doing and all the work that you do maintaining a really agreeable Facebook group, which again is a pluralist accord of differences united by universal love and struggle.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, never go back, never to go its back, old dimensions.
All right, that was Leo Zhao. Now, I usually try to keep these Sea Realm podcasts to exactly an hour, and this one is going to go over. I know some of you don't care. Some of you are pleased. But now that we've broken the one-hour mark anyway, I'm going to ramble on for a bit. Not forever, but for a bit. First off, I want to thank the generous sponsors of this episode of the Sea Realm podcast. This particular episode of the Sea Realm podcast is very well funded because it's been so long since I put one out, and there are people who have continued to send in those one-time donations. Now, I should say that my main source of financial support in this world is the Sea Realm Vault podcast and the people who subscribe to it. So while there are more of you than I can thank by name here on the Sea Realm podcast, let me thank you all as a group for subscribing. And also, I want to thank James S., who has arranged to have a monthly check sent my way by mail. It's all automated, but he could stop it at any time. So thanks, as always, to James S.
Rob M. has been a longtime friend and supporter of the Sea Realm podcast, and he made three separate donations to the Sea Realm podcast during its long hiatus. Again, I haven't put one of these shows out since May of this year. Carl G. and Eric L. make monthly contributions in the amount of $3. Now, this $3 monthly support option is something that I created somewhere in the neighborhood of 2008. And there has not been an option on the Sea Realm website to sign up for those $3 a month donations in many, many years. So Carl G. and Eric L. have been making these $3 monthly donations for years. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Also, Laura and Bill, longtime and very generous supporters of the Sea Realm podcast, have continued that tradition of generous support. So thank you very much to Laura and Bill. Jeffrey D. also contributed in the long hiatus of the Sea Realm podcast, so thanks to Jeffrey. And now, one more announcement about support for the Sea Realm and the various projects that I engage in, and then I will leave off that topic for now. I have had a Patreon page for a long time, but I set it up basically around the comic strip that I was doing for a while. That comic strip, the production technology and method that I chose for that was entirely too time-consuming. It took about 20 hours to do each one of those, and that just does not fit into my life and hasn't for a while. But I have revamped the Patreon page, and it is now possible to subscribe to the Sea Realm Vault podcast through Patreon. And as a little added incentive, and apologies to the existing Sea Realm Vault subscribers who are paying $8 a month for that, subscribing to the Sea Realm Vault podcast through Patreon costs $7 a month. There is no $80 year in advance option on Patreon, so you can't get that level of savings, but that $80 a year subscription option is about to go away on SeaRealm.com as well. People who are already subscribed in that fashion can continue, but there'll be no new $80 subscriptions. Now, let me encourage you one more time to consider my Patreon account. I will be posting just odds and ends to Patreon and making all of those things available to everybody who pledges $1 a month. I know a lot of you are among the precariat listening to this. And for you, this podcast is absolutely free. I ask nothing for it in return except that you consider the ideas that you hear in it. But for a lot of you, a $1 a month contribution would result in absolutely no pain whatsoever and no noticeable change in your lifestyle. So if that describes you, please consider going to Patreon and just doing a search for KMO, just the letters, KMO, and subscribing at the $1 a month level. I will be sure to keep your Patreon feed updated with interesting stuff. And you, along with everybody else who contributes at that level, will be helping to support me in my life as a, what's called a creative. And I don't know why, but that bothers me. But I'm one of those people who is trying to figure out how to earn a living here in this new world, where the sorts of employment that people used to consider as just the normal way of getting along in the world is becoming rarer and rarer and less and less well compensated, in part thanks to artificial intelligence taking up all manner of routine tasks that used to be performed by humans for pay. All right, well, Sea Realm Vault subscribers know that once I pick up the mic and start talking, I can go on for quite a long time, and I'm not going to do that in this instance. But thanks very much to all of you who have continued to listen to my weekly output as the Sea Realm radio show. And I can't promise that the regular Sea Realm podcast is going to return, you know, as a regular feature of your life, but I will put one out from time to time just to keep this channel of communication open. All right, now for feedback. If you want to give me feedback, really the best way to do it, I think, is to go to SeaRealm.com, look for this episode, again, this is episode number 515, and just post your comment right there, because then anybody who looks at this episode a year from now, 5 years from now, you know, assuming the internet is still around in 5 years, which I think it will be, your comment will be right there associated with this episode and this topic. You can also send me email. My email address is kmo@c-realm.com. That's C-R-E-A-L-M. I cannot promise a substantial response to your email. So if you want to share your thoughts, not just with me, but with other people, post it to crealm.com or to the Friends of the Sea Realm group on Facebook. All right. Now, in closing, let me say that usually I introduce guests more thoroughly than I did Leo in this episode. You can find Leo on Facebook. And I particularly recommend that you check out his group. Again, it's called A Pluralist Accord of Differences United by Universal Love and Struggle. But I don't expect you to remember that long title. Even Leo didn't remember it when I put him on the spot to produce it just from memory. So there will be a link to it in the show notes for this episode on crealm.com, where you will also be able to find a link to my Patreon page. But I'm just KMO on Patreon, so you should be able to find me pretty easily. All right, that is all for this episode of the CRealm podcast. Thanks so much for listening, and I will talk to most of you again very soon. And for those of you who only tune in for the official CRealm podcast, well, I will talk to you again in the fullness of time. Stay well.